Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Harry Truman once said, and I'm paraphrasing, "There's nothing new in this old world, just the history you don't know." Well, my guest today has made reviving and illuminating the history we don't know his life's mission. Andrew Carroll is the editor of the New York Times bestsellers War Letters and Behind the Lines. His War Letters project went far beyond merely a book. Carroll ended up collecting around 100,000 letters, ranging from the Civil War, the World Wars, through the Persian Gulf. He's now donating that collection to a new museum devoted to American war letters in Southern California. He hopes to have a similar effect with his latest project and book, devoted to forgotten history. Here is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History, is about seeking out and commemorating significant but unidentified historic sites. In his book, he documents the U.S.'s biggest maritime disaster, documents famous inventors whose names are lost to us today but whose inventions are essential to us, like television, vaccines, and cruise control, and strange quirks and stories that do make history fascinating. Here is Where is the name of the new book. Andrew Carroll is the new director of the Center for American War Letters I mentioned earlier at Chapman University. They hope to open on Veterans Day of 2014. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Andrew Carroll, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is a really fascinating book because it gets into the fascinating parts of American history, which is, of course, great storytelling. How did this book begin to take shape? The beginning story is about a meeting between Booth and Lincoln, and it's not the Booth and it's not the Lincoln that you think of, but they're related. Actor Edwin Booth and Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert Lincoln.
Yeah, and just to take it back a little bit, it's one of the ironies is that I had no interest in history growing up. I was not one of these kids who loved to go to battlefields and things like that. I really found history quite boring, to be honest. And my sophomore year of college, our house in Washington, D.C. burned down, and nobody was hurt, thank goodness, but everything we had was destroyed. And it was losing all that family memorabilia, the photos and letters and so forth, that really got me sort of interested in just preserving the past. And I started a project years ago to save America's war letters, and as I was reading through all these, you know, incredible previously unpublished correspondences, I was just coming across these stories I'd never heard before. And as you alluded to, one of the most incredible took place during the Civil War, and there was a young man standing on a train platform in Jersey City, New Jersey, and he slipped and fell in between the train and the platform, and he was stuck there. The conductor didn't see him and signaled for the train to move forward. And he was just about to get crushed under the wheels when another man just rushed over, grabbed him by the lapels, and pulled him to safety. And the young man who fell was Robert Todd Lincoln, who was at that point, his father was president. This is about 1863, 1864. And the man who saved his life was Edwin Booth. So a year before the assassination, you have this extraordinary encounter between the son of the president and the brother of the assassin. And I thought when I first heard the story, this must be apocryphal. It's just one of those things that sounds like it's been embellished. But sure enough, I came across a letter that Robert Todd Lincoln himself wrote describing this moment, really just second by second and what happened. And so it got me thinking, like, and I went to this site in Jersey City, and I was just wondering, like, God, there must be a marker here about this incident. Nothing at all. And just gradually over the years, I began accumulating these stories of something remarkable historically, but there's no plaque or sign or marker there, and it's just somehow been forgotten.
And, you know, this is a great contrast because, say, when you go to Europe, everything is marked. The whole history, you know, if the building has any significance, there's usually a marker detailing that significance. If you go to whatever, a public spaces, generally there's a marker telling you about any sort of history that happened at these places. In America, not so much, although it used to be different. We used to, you know, if you drive Western highways, you'll see historical markers all over the place. But that's changed over the years.
And one of the problems is that so many states just don't have the funding to put up these markers. I mean, they are expensive. I worked with a historian in Memphis, Tennessee, because part of this project is not just finding these sites and writing about them as I do in Here Is Where, but it's about bringing attention to them and hopefully getting markers put up. And one of the most incredible stories I came across, that's early on in the book, is about the Sultana. And this is a ship that was taking about 2,000 Union soldiers who had been prisoners of war. They had survived Gettysburg. They had been through the worst of the fighting, and they were finally going home. And just outside of Memphis on the Mississippi River, the ship blew up, and about 1,800 men and women, mostly men, either drowned in the Mississippi or died in the fire. And it's worse than the Titanic. More people died from the Sultana than on the Titanic, and yet everyone knows the Titanic, and nobody knows about the Sultana. I shouldn't say nobody, but very few people know about the Sultana. So we worked to put up a marker, an official state marker, at the site where the ship, you know, essentially went down. And so that's, you know, and one of the things I really hope this book will do is inspire people to find their own forgotten history sites, you know, even in their own neighborhood or community. And anyone who goes to our website, hereiswhere.org, can, you know, email us and say, hey, I've got an idea for you. And that's what I love about this project. Or teachers are having their students look for these forgotten history sites in their communities. And instead of just being sort of passive listeners or readers about history, they're actively going out and finding these spots. And to me, again, that's the best. That's what I love so much about working on this project.
Now, it's amazing. This was America's worst maritime disaster ever. 1,800 souls lost. And yet, I think you write in the book, it says, well, even within a couple of years, nobody knew about the Sultana. And there was an interesting reason for that.
Yeah, and a couple things, mostly because it got eclipsed by Lincoln's assassination, that everyone was just so fixated on that and the manhunt for John Wilkes Booth. And one of the sad codas to the story is, as they originally buried most of the guys in a cemetery south of Memphis, just sort of hastily to get them in the ground, and then they decided to move them to a national veterans cemetery up in Memphis. And
yes.
Jerry took me to this spot. And when you go there, it says, you know, unknown Civil War soldier, unknown Civil War soldiers, rows of these columns, and it didn't have to be that way. But when they disinterred the men and put them in caskets to go up to Memphis, a storm broke out, and all the names have been written on the caskets in chalk. And because the train was an open-air, you know, sort of storage thing, all the names got washed away. And so it's just sort of, you know, these guys just, you know, one thing after another, were just hit with just this terrible luck. And so it's one of the more powerful stories in the book. I mean, not everything I focus on is, you know, about the Civil War, or I would like to say that depressing. There's some really uplifting stories about great inventors and heroes and soldiers and civil rights pioneers. But that certainly was one of the most, I thought, interesting that I'd come across.
Well, since you're talking about the Civil War, I do want to mention a new piece of history to me, and that is about the first major domestic terror attack. And it happened during the Civil War, and it was a group of Southern officers who infiltrated the North and went to New York City, and their plan was to create a mass terrorist event.
Yeah, and it actually relates to the Booth-Lincoln story. This is how I came across it, because I knew, you know, obviously we all know about John Wilkes Booth. I didn't know much about Edwin, and so I was just researching him and the other brothers, the Booth brothers, and it turns out there's only one night that the three Booth brothers performed together. They were all actors, and it was a benefit performance of William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, and it was to raise money to put up a statue of Shakespeare in Central Park, which is there to this day. And that same night, November 25th, 1864, was the same night that New York was hit with its first terrorist attack. And again, just as you said, these Southern agents came up, and they tried to burn down the city. They failed, of course, but the Booth brothers were in a theater that had actually caught on fire because of it. And so it's just interesting how you have all these intersections of history happening at once.
And that's the wonderful thing about this book is you make these sort of intersections throughout the book. My guest today is Andrew Carroll. He is the author of Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. And it isn't all just about the Civil War. One of the more interesting stories to me, which shows our ignorance at times too, is the story of Prometheus. Now, what is Prometheus?
Yes, that was a story I did about the oldest living organism in America, and actually some would say in the world, but I think the more accurate say in America. And it was an almost 5,000-year-old tree, and it was in a certain part of Nevada, and a scientist, ironically, asked permission from the Forest Service if he could cut it down to count its rings, not knowing that it was the oldest tree, but just that it was a very old tree. It was a bristlecone pine, and they lived thousands and thousands of years. And so after they cut it down and counted the rings, they realized, oh my goodness, we've just destroyed the, you know, the oldest living organism in America. And so I actually did the hike up into this, you know, it's like way out in the woods, And I really wanted to show people the diversity of places. I mean, some things are like, you know, right downtown, whether it's in New York or Boston or Los Angeles, and some things are out in the middle of nowhere. And so it was, I wanted to do something not just on, you know, humans and great Americans, but of this, you know, trees and so forth. And it was just this amazing story of Prometheus. So that was, I mean, I don't want to say it's comical because it's a horrible thing that happened, but it was just so, you know, there is something funny about this idea of these scientists who want to preserve nature destroyed this living organism. And so now the next contender, it's called Methuselah, is in California, and it's pretty much, you know, kept under wraps because people don't want to know where it is and so forth. But that is now the oldest living organism in the U.S.
Now, I know that it was a long hike in Great Basin National Park on
exactly.
the Nevada border. But were the rangers aware of Prometheus? Is this something?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. It's famous among the rangers. And in fact, they were very. A ranger took me out to the site, and he had to go out in that area anyway, because otherwise you just have to do it by GPS or, you know, however. But he took me to the site, and we saw, and the remains are still there. So it's really sad because you just see this, you know, what was once this beautiful tree just sort of scattered all about on the ground. And but it was a beautiful hike, and it's one of the things I wanted to, you know, convey in the book is that there are all these great sites around us, and some of them will take you to the most beautiful places in America. I went to little islands that were out in the middle of nowhere, kayaked out there, or helicoptered, or whatever it might be. And it's just incredible the diversity of where these places are.
Now, you managed to visit the Hawaiian island that virtually nobody goes to, and that's Niihau.
Right. It's the smallest of the Hawaiian islands, of the populated islands. It's the last of the populated islands. It's all the way to the west. And it's privately owned. So you can go out there because the family runs like a helicopter service to go visit it. And I don't want to give away the story because I want to leave some, you know, things for the readers to discover on their own. But there's this incredible thing that happened there on December 7th, 1941 that had huge implications across the country. And it, again, has been sort of forgotten. But that was actually one of the most exciting trips because, you take this helicopter from Kauai and then you go out to Niihau, and it's just a really beautiful little spot. And I wanted to go there to verify there was no marker or plaque. I did this with all the different sites to make sure they were truly unmarked. So that was a great experience as well.
Now, as you are doing these travels, did you find things, parts of history that you thought, well, nobody will have marked this, and there were some things marked?
Yeah, and I wouldn't write them. I wouldn't put them in the book because the whole focus of the book are places that have gone sort of overlooked. But no, I actually flew out to the middle of Montana. It's one of the longest trips I took to get out there, and then I had to drive like 6 hours to get to this site. And the historian who told me about it, I think, just forgot that I was looking for unmarked sites. And once we got out there, sure enough, there's this huge plaque, and I was like, oh, well, I can't write about this one.
What was the story? What was the story?
It was about a massacre of Native Americans in a part of Montana, and there's even some debate on where exactly it took place, so that was also another problem, is that the marker was like somewhere around this vicinity, you know, could be 20 miles away, could be 50 miles away, so I just, unfortunately, I couldn't go into it, but, you know, that's why I wanted to go to these places, to absolutely confirm myself that there really was no plaque or marker.
You know, it's funny because my father was a band director here in Oklahoma, and he dedicated plaques for the Battle of Round Mountain three different times in three different locations.
Oh, wow.
Because they kept moving them around.
Oh, that's so interesting, the Battle of Round Mountain.
Which was, you know, it was a skirmish during the Civil War. And they thought originally it happened somewhere between Stillwater and Yale in central Oklahoma. Then it was up in northeastern Oklahoma. Then it was somewhere west of Tulsa.
You know, and it's, you know, you mentioned Oklahoma, and I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the Oklahoma story. And this is a case where when I went to the site, it was right next to something that was incredibly significant. And
yes.
And yet, you know, where the site that I was talking about is unmarked. But I did a thing on eugenics in America, which is sort of a part of our history that we have, you know, forgotten, and probably for good reason. But it was a really terrible part of American history where we were, you know, whether it was prisoners or people in institutions, that we were sterilizing them because people didn't want them to have children. And Jack Skinner, who was caught in Oklahoma City for doing this small-time crime, he was set to be sterilized under Oklahoma law. This is back in 1934. And he and his fellow prisoners actually raised funds to get a legal campaign, and it was the beginning of the end of sterilization and eugenics in the United States. And where the robbery took place which is the site that I talk about, is literally right next to where the memorial is for the Oklahoma City bombing. And I didn't know that when I got there. And it was just interesting, sort of, again, this intersection of history of what happened there and Timothy McVeigh, who held very similar views as the people who were leading the eugenics things back in the 1900s.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because the way you wrote the book, these stories sort of pile out of one another, because that section actually begins with a story of a great conservationist.
Yeah, and it's I start off, and this is sort of like the Prometheus section where I'm talking about things outside of nature and so forth, and I talk about this guy, Madison Grant, who is the reason we have the Redwood Forest. They would have been destroyed back in the early 1900s because the timber industry was just wiping them out. And he said, these are so beautiful, magnificent, you have to save them. And he was also instrumental in saving the bison, the American bison, that is, and all sorts of other animals. And he's sort of like a John Muir type, who's the great, you know, founder of the Sierra Club. But no one knows about Madison Grant. And then, so I talk about him in that first chapter. Then I transition to another chapter where I talk about why Madison Grant has been forgotten, and with somewhat good reason, is that he was the leading eugenicist in America. And it was sort of his ideas that even the Nazis were using him as a friend and as a reference and as a fellow, in, quote-unquote, intellectual in their efforts, and he was sort of educating them. So he's a really terrible, terrible person, and it's just interesting how, on the one hand, here's the guy who saved the Redwoods, but yet he's also someone that, you know, is just a horrible individual. So that's the interesting thing about history, is what do you do with these people? And there's even a plaque where the Redwoods are up in California that mentions his name, and a lot of people have written to the Park Service saying, you have got to take down this plaque. It's sort of like, you know, putting up a marker for Adolf Hitler for helping to invent the Volkswagen. You know, it's just... So, you know, and that's what somebody wrote in, saying this is just an abomination. And then the park director wrote back.
It was a wonderful letter, too.
Yeah, and he was an African-American individual, and he was like, look, if anyone knows about racism and discrimination, it's me. But here, if I have to take this plaque down, you have to take down every plaque to Teddy Roosevelt, to Margaret Sanger, I mean, all these different individuals, because a lot of people held these eugenics views back in the early 1900s.
Yeah, there was a great line, and I want to try to find it, because it really says, it was talking about the past versus the present.
Yep.
We have to judge people from their present day as opposed to...
He mentions in this response, this is, again, the Park Service director. He says, you know, I say only that I'm African-American, you know, that I do not take lightly your request for removal of the plaque, and that I can quite understand and appreciate the reasoning behind your request. I would hope that you will understand, too, my decision to not have the plaque removed. Harmony among people comes from the true principles and attitudes of the present, not from purging the past.
Yeah, that's a really good line. Yeah.
But it's, yeah, and that's, you know, I love delving into these sort of larger questions of why does history matter, and who do we celebrate, who do we honor, and, you know, what if they have something in their past, like Thomas Jefferson, you know, great, you know, one of the heroes of our time, and yet was a slave master. And, you know, here he was writing about liberty and even put in the original Declaration of Independence this total castigation of the King of England for being involved with the slave trade, and here was Jefferson owning slaves. So it gets into these issues, and I love, you know, when I go to schools and colleges and we talk about these, and it really sparks these great debates. And I think that's what makes history so, you know, exciting, is when you really have these intense discussions about what do we remember, what do we forget, and why.
My guest today is Andrew Carroll. He is the author of Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to ask about one more story before we talk about your War Letters project, because this is really taking off as well. But you mentioned the whole idea is getting folks to actually acknowledge this history that is forgotten, that, you know, you may walk by a location where, you know, a significant event took place and just totally unaware. And this was another trip to Montana, because you were looking for the birthplace of Dr. Maurice Hilleman. Now, that name is probably forgotten to most people, although if you're an immunologist, you know who Dr. Maurice Hilleman is. He developed about half of the world's vaccines. You go to Miles City, what did you find?
Well, and I'm so glad you mentioned Maurice Hilleman, because we've been focusing on a lot of the darker aspects of American history, but I really do try and focus on these great inventors, medical pioneers, people who've, you know, done so much good in America and are so heroic. And it's interesting, every time I meet someone who's like interested in science or even works in scientific community, I'm like, have you heard of Dr. Maurice Hilleman? 95% like, never heard that name before. And as you said, He helped invent many of the vaccines that we all get when we're children, and it's estimated that he saved literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of lives because of the vaccines that he invented. And so he's from this tiny, tiny town in Montana, and Miles City, as you mentioned, I went there to see, well, there must be a plaque or marker, you know, near the house where he was born, and he's literally a stone's throw from the Historical Society. And you walk in there, and they have all these portraits of great, you know, individuals from Montana and so forth. Nothing about Maurice Hilleman. He just got completely forgotten somehow, and part of it was he's such a modest guy. He's since passed away, but he never, like, you know, we all know the Salk vaccine for polio and so forth. He never named any of his vaccines after himself, and that was part of the issue, that's why he's been neglected, is that, you know, he was very quiet about his accomplishments. But I would really love to get something put up in Miles City because he is such an incredible figure.
Well, it's actually, when you went there, people said, no, I've never heard of that person. Well, you know, he invented about half of the world's vaccines, and they go, oh, you're putting me on.
No, exactly. And that's the funny thing is that, you know, if he were from anywhere in America, there should be like a statue or a park named after him. But the fact that he is from this tiny little town where you would sort of think the word would get around. But again, and it was funny because his nephew, I think it was, took me around the city as a tiny town, and you know, he's like, look, Maurice was just a very quiet, almost shy guy that he just didn't want a lot of attention.
Since you brought it to their attention, are they thinking about doing something?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the mayor who I met while I was out there is no longer there, but there's a new mayor. And so I kind of want to reestablish contact with them, but they're definitely planning on doing something.
Yeah. Well, the last part of the book talks about places lost to history, and you start with Leary's Bookstore in Philadelphia, which was torn down, I believe, in 1969. And this was a pretty historic place.
It was, and the focus really wasn't even on Leary's, which was, many say, the oldest continuously running bookstore in America, but what was found there. So as they were closing down the shop in 1969-70, they were, you know, just packing up the books and the crates, and they came across one of the original Dunlop broadsides. And what these were the Declarations of Independence printed up on the night of July 4th, 1776, and distributed throughout the colonies. So the declaration that everyone's sort of familiar with, which is the one at the National Archives, was actually done weeks later, and it was they got almost all the signatories on that one. But these Dunlop broadsides are older than that declaration at the National Archives, and so they were disseminated throughout the colonies to spread the word about that, you know, we wanted to revolt and so forth. And there are only like a couple dozen that people have been able to find, and there were hundreds written up in 1776. And so there was one found in this bookstore, and it's now on display at the Dallas Public Library. And, you know, if you're ever through Dallas, I recommend people go see it because it's really cool to see this document that, again, is older than the one at the National Archives.
Was the broadsides printed at that location?
They were printed down the street because Philadelphia was so small at that point that John Dunlop, he was the printer, he was an Irish immigrant, actually was just a few blocks from there, but Leary's wasn't there at the time. That came later.
Yeah. Well, out of that section, you talk about all the buildings we've lost and all the really significant structures, and it's a pretty long list. And again, it contrasts greatly with elsewhere in the world where the history is a little more revered, I guess.
Well, and one of the things I actually took out of the book because it was just getting a little bit cumbersome was a whole other list. I did something in New Orleans, which I had to take out, but I allude to it in the back. And of all the buildings, these great buildings have been torn down to make parking lots. And parking lots are sort of the bane of American history. We've literally paved over so much of these really beautiful and significant buildings. And so there's even a much longer list than what I go into. But it's amazing. You take like Ford's Theater. It was completely in disrepair and almost would have been demolished until eventually people were like, well, this is really a significant site where President Lincoln was assassinated. We should try and refurbish it and honor him through it. So, you know, and the Alamo was going to be torn down. And I tell a story about a woman who barricaded herself inside the Alamo to keep it from being destroyed. So what I focus on in the ending are the places that have been saved and the heroic individuals who've really worked to preserve our past.
Yeah. Well, another way you're trying to preserve the past is your War Letters project. Now, this came out of that fire that you mentioned at the beginning. Somebody sent you a family war letter. And
that's right. A distant cousin of my father, when he heard about the fire, called to see how we were doing, just to check in, you know, family, like, you know, how are you guys, are you okay, and so forth. And I said, you know, we've lost all of our letters, all of our photographs. And he said, you know, I've just been going through my old memorabilia from World War II, and I'll send you something I wrote in 1945. And it was this incredible letter that he wrote as a 22-year-old pilot, and he saw the liberation of Buchenwald. And so he was writing home to his wife about what he witnessed at the liberation of this concentration camp. And I thanked Jim for sending it to me. I said, hey, I'll mail it back to you. He said, you know what, just keep it. I probably would have tossed it anyway. And just the idea that he would have thrown out something so valuable was really stunning to me. And just talking to other veterans, I found out that they, too, had been throwing out their letters. And so I began this effort called the Legacy Project to preserve the legacy of these great men and women who served our country. And we're still looking for letters from any war in our nation's history. And anyone can go to our website, warletters.us, and we'll give them information on the whole project and why we're doing this. And so since I started this project back in 98, people have sent me about 100,000 letters from every war in America's history. We're even doing a play based on it, and I was just in Moore, Oklahoma, because they did a performance of it at the high school there, and you know, we're colleges and professional theaters are doing it as well. But it was really great to come to Oklahoma, and the kids were phenomenal, and it was just a really great experience.
Now, you've donated those 100,000 letters to a new center that will be opening up in the next year or two.
Correct, yes. There's a university out in California called Chapman, and that's actually where we premiered the play. I fell in love with the community, and I said, I'd like to donate the war letters to you all. They said, we will archive them, catalog them, exhibit them. We don't want to just put them in a storage area and lock it up. We want these letters out there so people can really, you know, get a sense of the sacrifices these troops have made. And it is really meant to be kind of a memorial to those who serve, because these are their voices, their stories, and I don't think anybody can tell their story better than they can.
And, of course, one of the great ironies is this era is perhaps over. Our most recent conflicts, email has been the communication choice available.
And we like emails, too. As long as it's something that the troops have written, so much of it today is texting or Skype, and that just disappears almost instantly. But troops are still writing letters and emails. And I went to Iraq, I went to Afghanistan, and people shared with me things that they had written. So, there's definitely hope out there, and I hope the project will also inspire people to write letters. And, because there's never been a better time to write letters in our history, because when you do it now, the implicit message is you're worth the time. And so, again, I hope this will inspire, whether it's troops or anyone, but to, write to one another every so often, and just knowing that that letter will be cherished for many years to come.
Now, the Here Is Where project is not over, even though the book is out. You're planning a big road trip across the country. What's the plan for doing that?
Well, part of it will be also look for war letters. I'm calling it the Save America's History Tour. And so it'll be looking for war letters. I'll be going to various places across the country, but also to go to various sites. Like, I'm going to go in New York, where the first cell phone call in history was made, and we want to put a marker up there. There's a great story behind that. But also the slave who built the Statue of Freedom atop the Capitol. We're putting a really nice bronze marker at the cemetery where he's buried, but there was his name was not there, and so we want to bring attention to him. So it's to put up markers in various places, and I love it when people come out and say, "Hey, I've got a place you should look into." That's the real joy of this whole project.
Well, it's a really interesting book too, as well. Here Is Where. Andrew Carroll, thanks very much for joining us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Writer Andrew Carroll speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. It's published by Crown. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and you can look through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.